We're continuing our series this morning on 12 Who Dared. I keep telling you what we're doing because I know it's not always as obvious to you as it is to me that we're actually doing a series. And we're doing a series on the 12 disciples of Jesus. And we've spent a great deal of time already talking about how Jesus took on the role of a rabbi and they were his disciples and what that meant. We've looked at his demands on them some. We've looked at their weaknesses. We've looked at the culture in which they lived. Most of all, what has come out of this already, and which will continue to come out of it, is how these were very ordinary men. The scriptures will later say of the apostles, as they will be called by Jesus, that they are the very foundation of the church. And yet, they hardly look like foundation when we first see them in the Gospels. They often argue with each other, sometimes even with Jesus. They are hard of understanding, hard of hearing, Jesus even accuses them of being. They lack faith, they lack courage, they lack direction. And so he works for these 3+ years of his public ministry, not only in doing miracles and teaching others, but in bringing these men to a strong enough faith and a strong enough understanding of what he was about that they might continue his work once he goes back to heaven. At many points along the way, as we look in the Gospels, we might well question, is this going to work? It doesn't look very promising many times. And yet he knew what he was doing and he knew what he could accomplish. And the end result was 12 men, 11 actually, because he loses one, 11 men, and a 12th who is added to them, and then eventually a 13th, who even says of himself that he was born out of season. Just kind of an odd situation. That expression would mean that, as I know with my daughter-in-law right now, about 6 weeks after she was pregnant, they told everybody, we're expecting. Everybody starts looking at their calendar. Okay, second half of July. She goes to the doctor. He confirms that. She starts showing that she's expecting. And with God's help, here sometime after the middle of next month, our 9th grandchild will be born. But what happens if someone suddenly announces, I'm pregnant, and tomorrow they go to the hospital and have a baby? Is that possible? Not physically. But that's actually the expression Paul uses to describe how he became an apostle. That he was born out of due season. That means he was born without a 9-month gestation period of forming and shaping and so forth. That God chose him without all of that. Now certainly God was already working in his life in other ways to produce it. But what we're looking at right now are the 12 that went through the process. 12 who dared to put their faith in Jesus. 12 who dared to follow him. 12 who dared to do what he told them to do. 12 who dared to take the gospel into all the world. And we're at the point starting this morning that we can now talk about some of them individually. And when we start talking about each of these men individually, the place always to begin is with Peter. Why Peter? Because of the 4 times that all 12 are named, he's always named first. Because of the 12, he is talked about and talked to the most. If you look at just his name, of course he had 2 names, and we'll talk about that some this morning. Simon and Peter. He is mentioned over 200 times in the New Testament. The next apostle to him, in terms of mentions, is John, 31 times. It seems clear that in the minds of the writers of the New Testament, Peter was first. Now, we know that since the New Testament, that a part of Christianity has taken this firstness, this primacy, as it's sometimes called, of Peter, and turned it into something they might well call supremacy. And I don't think that's supported by the scriptures. There's a difference between Peter being sort of first out there in front, both of the other apostles and out there in front of the church in its beginning, and somehow going from that to saying he was somehow intended to be supreme, and that that firstness that he had was intended to be passed on to those after him to take the same role. That's not supported as far as I can see in the scriptures. But Peter clearly has the most prominent role of all the 12 in our New Testament. And what we know about him from the scriptures, and that's what we mostly want to talk about, is what we know about him from the scriptures, falls into three stages in his life. First of all, that part we know and can know about him before he became a disciple of Jesus. And then secondly, that period of time in which he is one of the disciples. That would be the period from when he's first called, in the passage that Don read to us in John chapter 1, verses 40 through 42, all the way through until he has that meeting with Jesus up by the Sea of Galilee after Jesus' resurrection, and Jesus tells him to feed my sheep. That's the second stage of his life. There's that life before Jesus, then that life with Jesus, and then the third stage will be his life as an apostle, an evangelist, and missionary, starting with the book of Acts. And so we want to look at that. We will spend more time with him because, as we've already mentioned, we can know so much more about him from the New Testament. The only other person in the New Testament other than Jesus that we can know so much about besides Peter is Paul. We draw most of that from, of course, Acts and the epistles of Paul. But we can know quite a bit about Peter, probably more than we at first realize. And so we start that study together this morning. What about his life before Jesus? On the one hand, we might scratch our heads and say, well, we really don't know anything about him before Jesus. Oh, yes, we do, actually. First of all, we know that his name was Simon. Simon, or Simeon, that would be the Old Testament form of that name. Simeon was one of the sons of Jacob, and therefore became the father of one of the tribes, the 12 tribes of Israel. He was the second born of Jacob. Now that really doesn't directly have anything to do with Peter, except that Peter's named after him. Scholars tell us that in the New Testament period of time, that would be the first century, that Simon or Simeon was the most common of all Jewish names for men. So he had a very common name. We can see quite a number of other people in the New Testament who also had that name. There was the man in the temple that meets Joseph and Mary when they first come there with the infant Jesus. He was an elderly man who was there at the temple. It identifies him as a prophet by the name of Simeon. In Luke chapter 3, when Luke gives us the genealogy of Jesus, we find that Jesus had an ancestor named Simon or Simeon. While Jesus was doing his ministry, he not only called this man Simon to be one of his disciples, but another one of his disciples was actually named Simon. He is identified or separated from this Simon we know by being called Simon the Zealot or Simon Zelotes. And yet two of therefore, Jesus' own 12 had the same name. Jesus will go to dinner with a man called Simon the Pharisee. At least that's how he's identified. In another place, he goes to a banquet with another man named Simon the Leper. Now, clearly, when Jesus has the dinner with him, he's not a leper anymore. Probably he had been a leper, and perhaps even Jesus had healed him. That seemed to be most reasonable, and that might even be why they're having the dinner together, because Jesus had healed him of his leprosy. But Simon the leper. Later, after the church begins, we know of a man in the church in Antioch, according to Acts chapter 13, who was called Simon, also called Niger, or the black. When Jesus was being carried out to be crucified, the Roman soldiers actually grab a man out of the crowd called Simon. Simon of Cyrene, to help Jesus carry the cross. So there were plenty of people, even in the New Testament, who had that name. So there's nothing so much about the name itself, Simon, except it was just a very common Jewish name of that time. But we're also told who he was the son of. They didn't normally have, as we call them, last names. And in fact, if we know a little bit about the whole subject of last names, like my last name is Cravey or Kirk or Belk or whatever your last name is, if we actually do a little study on our own last names, we discover that our last names actually came from ways of once designating our ancestors to distinguish them from each other when they had the same first names. And so you'd have in the New Testament with our Simon we're studying today, Simon Bar-Jonah, which indicated what is who his father was. And yet there was this other Simon, who was a disciple of Jesus, designated not by who his father was, but by what his political convictions were. Simon Zelotes, Simon the Zealot. When you think about many names today, that's really where they came from as well. In the business center where my son has his business, three doors down from him is a lawyer, and his name is Chris Carpenter. What do you think his ancestors did? Even Ed Kirk. Kirk is an old name for the church. Now, I certainly haven't done the research on it, but somewhere back there, probably one of Ed's ancestors was a prominent leader or a worker of some kind in the church. Or let's take Claude. I'm not picking on you, Claude, but your last name is Johnson. Think about that a moment. Claude John's son. Peter was Simon Bar Jonah. Bar was Aramaic word for son of. And Jonah is just a contracted form of the word John in New Testament times. And so in one place it calls him Bar Jonah. Later over in the Gospel of John it actually calls him Simon son of John. And it was the same. So he literally, by our way of thinking today, his real name was Simon Johnson. Sound like a relative of yours from a long time ago. Simon Bar-Jonah. And many other names in the New Testament like that as well. We find that there was a man named Bar-Jesus. There was Bartholomew, one of Jesus' disciples. Bartimaeus. Barabbas, the man who was set free while Jesus was crucified. And even a prominent leader in the early church, Barnabas. And we're even told in the book of Acts that Barnabas really meant son of encouragement. Barnabas. His real name was Joseph. But everybody ended up calling him by his nickname. Because encouragement wasn't his father's name, but he's called son of encouragement. James and John are called the sons of thunder by Jesus. Boanerges. So, very common in their time to distinguish one person from another, not just by their first name, but by some attention to who their father was, as in his case, Bar-Jonah, or by some outstanding characteristic about that person, like the sons of thunder or Simon Zelotes. In Peter's case, he was Simon Bar-Jonah. We're told here in John chapter 1, just almost immediately after Jesus calls him, that he was from the small town of Bethsaida. For it says in John chapter 1 and verse 43 and 44, the next day Jesus decided to leave for Galilee. Finding Philip, he said to him, "Follow me." Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Bethsaida. In the New Testament, we have two different towns named Bethsaida. If you were looking at a map of the Sea of Galilee, at the very top, where the Jordan River runs down into the Galilee Lake, right there, next to the Jordan, was a small town called Bethsaida. Bethsaida of Galilee. Now, Bethsaida literally means, Beth is for house. House of. Seda meant house of fishermen, or house of fish, or house of fishing. Any of those would fit. What do we know about Peter? He was a fisherman. Bethsaida was a fish camp that had grown into a town. And most of the people who lived there, at least originally, had been fishermen. That's why it was called the House of Fish. We have other house of places in the New Testament as well, like Bethlehem, which means house of bread, or Bethel, which means the house of God. That was a place was originally named that by Jacob way back in the Old Testament as a place where he met God, and he called it the house of God, Bethel. So he was from Bethsaida, it says, a small town on the northern part of the Sea of Galilee. A second Bethsaida existed around on the southeast corner of the lake, but it wasn't in Galilee. It was in Gaulonitis, a separate Roman territory down there. And Jesus goes there with his disciples a couple of times. It's near Bethsaida where he feeds the 5,000. It's there where he does some other miracles and some other things happen. But it's not to be confused with the little town up on the northern part of the lake where Peter, Andrew, and Philip, and maybe even James and John were originally from. But it's only about 3 miles from Capernaum. And so by the time we actually meet Peter, even though he's from Bethsaida, he's not living in Bethsaida. He's living in Capernaum, a much larger town, and he's there operating a business with his brother Andrew and as partners with James and John. Isn't this a fishing business? Also working in that business, along with them, others that are mentioned are the father of James and John, named Zebedee, and some servants, some other employees, in other words, that Zebedee has. So Peter was a successful businessman. He was a partner in a business that was doing quite well. Some have even speculated that they might have even had a contract with the house of the high priest down in Jerusalem, that a lot of the fish that they caught were prepared, dried, and exported down to Jerusalem for the household of the high priest. That's mentioned only because at a certain point when Jesus is arrested and taken into the house of the high priest, you might remember that John, one of the partners in the business, is allowed to go inside because he was, as it says in the scriptures, known to the family of the high priest. Now that would be very unusual for the high priest family to know some guy from up in Galilee. And yet it says of John, one of the partners in the business, they know him. They know him well enough to let him come in during a trial. They know him well enough to be persuaded by him to let Peter come in and stay out in the courtyard. So he's Simon Barjona from the small town of Bethsaida, but he now lives in Capernaum, a much larger town that has a small garrison of Roman soldiers there because there's a centurion we meet later who's in Capernaum. That means he's the head over 100. They have a toll booth, tax booth there because that's where Matthew is, just outside of town on the road collecting customs taxes. A road still runs, a Roman road runs from along the Mediterranean coast right into the ruins of Capernaum today, complete with the Roman mile markers along the way. So Capernaum was a pretty significant town. It was the largest town in that part of Galilee, right on the coast of the lake there. And that's where Peter lived. He had a house there. The scriptures tell us he had a house there. In Mark chapter 1 and verse 31, Jesus goes to Peter's house in Capernaum, and while he's there in his house, he heals Peter's mother-in-law. So what have we just learned? He's got a house in Capernaum. He's got a mother-in-law. What does that mean? At least in my case, if I have a mother-in-law, that means I've got a wife. That's the only way you can have a mother-in-law. Jesus heals his mother-in-law. We really don't hear about his wife directly there, but later the Apostle Paul will say in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, he talks about how Peter's wife sometimes traveled with Peter when he was doing missionary work. So he had a wife. Interestingly enough, the church, I'm talking about church in general, from about the 2nd century on, identified a certain building, or the ruins of a certain building in ancient Capernaum, as being the house of Peter. It still exists today. Eventually, a church was built next to it, a church building. And then in the 500s, a bigger church building was built over it. And now today, a building exists over it which has a glass floor in it, so you can stand there and look through the glass and see the ruins of this building underneath that is still identified, has been ever since the late 100s, early 200s of the church as the place where Peter lived. Is it the place where Peter lived? We don't know that for sure, but certainly he lived somewhere in Capernaum. And this is in Capernaum. And the church has believed, at least some part of it, for now more than 1,800 years, that it's the place where he lived. It was one part of a much larger building. People in New Testament times, up in Galilee, tended to live not in single family dwellings like we do today, but in almost like compounds, in which sometimes several generations of the same family and several siblings within the same generation would all be living together in their own parts of this larger compound. And that's what this building in Capernaum is. And in fact, when we read in the scriptures, we find out that it's not just the place where Peter lives, it's also the place where Andrew lives, his brother. And it is a place that at least at some times Jesus stayed while he was there. It might even be the same as where it says that Jesus, when he went to his own house, it might have just been one part of this compound that belonged to Peter's family that had now been designated as Jesus's. It's where they're tearing the hole in the roof to let the man down to be healed of his paralysis. It's where the crowds had gathered and there's so many they can't all fit inside, so they're standing at the door and looking in through the windows and so forth. We know all that. We may not know which building it is or even if the remains of it exist today, but we know such a building did exist. And it was Peter's house and Andrew's house, and at least at sometimes a place where Jesus also stayed. So he was from Capernaum. He was married. He had a wife. He had a mother-in-law. We have no mention of his children. And now we have this very interesting thing that happens here in John chapter 1 when Jesus first calls him. For it says there in John chapter 1, this is when Jesus had gone down to where John the Baptizer was, and John has not only baptized Jesus, but John has also identified Jesus to anyone who was around that, look, this is the Lamb of God. John is identifying Jesus as the one that's talked about back in Isaiah chapter 53, who's going to take away the sins of the world. And some of John the Baptizer's disciples, hearing John say this, they start following Jesus. And it's out of some of those who start following Jesus that Jesus picks out his 12, including Peter, Andrew, James, John, Philip, and Bartholomew, at least those. All come from being disciples of John first, and they turn and become disciples of Jesus. And it's in the midst of all that we read this here in John chapter 1, verse 40. Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, was one of the two who heard what John had said and who had followed Jesus. So probably John and Andrew are the first two who turned from John the Baptist to follow Jesus. And it says of Andrew that he's Simon Peter's brother. And yet he's not actually being called Peter yet. And it says in verse 41, the first thing Andrew did was to find his brother Simon and tell him, we have found the Messiah, that is, the Christ. Then he brought Simon to Jesus, who looked at him. And it's interesting there in the Greek language, the word looked is not just glance at or even to just cast your gaze upon, but it's the word in the Greek language that meant to look at and study. To examine. Jesus turned and looked at Simon and just studies him for a moment and then said, you are Simon, son of John. That is, perhaps Andrew's already told him, Master, here's my brother, Simon. So maybe that's how Jesus knows it, who he is. He says, you are Simon, son of John. You will be called Cephas, which when translated is Peter. Cephas is an Aramaic word that meant rock. Cephas was not the name of any person. People might be named Simon or Jonah or John or Andrew or Philip, but people were not named Cephas. Because Cephas was not the name of a person. It was the name of a thing. It was a rock. And yet Jesus is telling him, you will be called. He didn't say you will be named. He said you will be called rock. And it's not until Christianity began to spread across the Roman Empire that Christian families started naming their children after Simon and named them Peter, that the name Peter actually became the name of people instead of just the name of something. But when Jesus points to him and says, you're going to be called rock, that hadn't happened yet. Interesting. Later, in Luke chapter 6, when Jesus is going to, for the first time, designate his disciples as apostles, it tells us in Luke 6:14 that as he was designating them as apostles, he designated Simon, who he now called Peter. First he tells him, back when he first meets him, you will be called Peter, or Cephas. And then later, when he actually makes him an apostle, he now calls him Peter. And in Matthew chapter 16, whenever Jesus says, who do people say that I am? And they tell him various things. And finally he says, who do you say that I am? It's Simon who speaks up first and says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, I tell you the truth, you are Peter. So we sort of see this little progression taking place in the Gospels. He will be called Peter, whom he called Peter, and then he says, you are Peter. But there's an interesting thing here, perhaps you haven't ever noticed before. You read all four Gospels. Every time Jesus ever speaks to Peter, when we have actually words coming out of Jesus' mouth, you know what? He never once called him by the name Peter. Because Peter really wasn't his name. That was a title Jesus was giving him. You will be called Rock. So Jesus never said, Rock. He's designating what Peter will be, not so much what his name would be. He always called him Simon. From the first time he met him right here until the last time he talks to him in John chapter 21. That's the last time we actually have any words of Jesus directly to him that we have recorded. He always called him Simon. And even later, much later in the history of the early church, we get all the way over to the book of Acts chapter 15, when the church is meeting together in Jerusalem to try to decide what to do about these people who wanted to have Christians circumcised and wanted to insist that they keep the Sabbath day and all of that. Well, Luke, as he's writing that story in Acts chapter 15, says, and then Peter gets up and says, and he tells us what Peter says. But then after Peter says what he does, then Luke says, then James gets up and says, now who's James? He's one of Peter's former business partners, also one of the apostles. Or perhaps it's Jesus' brother. It's hard to tell which. It may actually be more likely Jesus' brother, James, who is now leader in the church. Whichever it is, that James then gets up and says, as Simon has told us, Luke calls him Peter. But James, another Galilean Jewish, now Christian, still calls him Simon, even all those years later. Why am I making such a big deal about this? Truthfully, because Jesus made a big deal about it. As Jesus is the one that said he'll be called Peter, or Cephas, and then gradually the church starts using it like it's part of his name, just like we use the word Christ now to say Jesus Christ. You know, Christ wasn't his last name. It was a designation of what he was. In the same way, Peter is a designation of what Simon was. Jesus saw him for what he would be, a rock, a solid part of what Jesus was going to build his church on. Now again, that's not giving in at all to what some later Christianity did and took that and went far beyond what God ever went with it. But Peter clearly was intended to be a solid foundation, a part of the solid foundation that Jesus would use to expand what he was doing out into all the world. Well, we'll have to pick up there next time. That's what we know pretty much about his life before Jesus. Simon Bar-Jonah of Bethsaida, a fisherman who had a business at Capernaum, had a house there, had partners there. Now we're ready next time to talk about Peter as a disciple of Jesus in the Gospels. Because he was a disciple of John the Baptist, that tells us a great deal about what his beliefs were and his expectations and hopes were. The fact that he grew up in Galilee as a Jewish boy and then man tells us actually quite a bit about what kind of education he had and so forth. Then when we read of all the interaction between him and Jesus in the Gospels, it tells us a great deal about how much Jesus was investing in him. And it's almost like he's investing all this in Peter as sort of the leader of the 12 because it has that trickle-down effect. The others learned in different ways, it seems, than Peter did. But Peter was the brash, forward, speak too quick, sometimes act too quick kind of person. Jesus, in dealing with him, was in effect teaching all of them what he wanted them to know. The biggest thing we get out of all of this is Jesus was able to take perfectly ordinary people who seemed to have no unusual qualities about them that would commend them to become what Jesus wanted them to become and what he would make them into. He was able to make them into what would be very valuable servants in God's kingdom. The same is true of us. We're all too human. We can think of all sorts of reasons why we aren't qualified to do or be what he wants us to do or be. And yet, we can be and we can do whatever he calls us to because he can make us what we need to be for him if we dare. And we have an invitation song that I know that song was written hundreds of years after Peter lived, but if it had been around when Peter was around, Peter would have fully agreed with the sentiments of it. Just as I am, without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me. Peter knew that the only reason he had become a servant of God and a servant of Jesus was because of what Jesus did. It wasn't because of what Peter did. If anyone needs to respond to the invitation this morning, you can come and do that now while we stand up and sing the song.